Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of all of the potential of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now, if you have been listening for a while, you know that one of my very favorite things to do on the show is to have guests, often Jewish guests. Very often they're Jewish guests who have also entered the Catholic Church. But today it is a slightly different situation, which is it is a new friend of mine, a Jewish guest who is, I hope he'll forgive me saying this, but probably one of the foremost experts in the world on the Shroud of Turin. And being that it is also the season of Lent, I thought it was a great opportunity to explore both the Shroud of Turin and the rather compelling scientific evidence that there is really no alternative to the hypothesis that it truly is the burial shroud of Jesus, and also what it tells us, frankly, about the passion and death of Jesus. And maybe also he will talk a little bit about what it was like to be one of the Jewish members of the Shroud of Turin research project and how he came to do a 180-degree turn from being a rather serious skeptic of the authenticity of the Shroud to a very fairly serious defender of its authenticity. So, without wasting more time, let me introduce him. His name is Barry Schwartz. Oh, let me just say, in case he forgets to, he is also the author and founder of the website Shroud.com, S-H-R-O-U-D, of course, .com, which is undoubtedly one of the best sites on the internet for finding out all about the Shroud. Both pro and con, in fact, because he has included links there to some of the attempts to discredit the authenticity of the Shroud. So if after this conversation you want to find out more about Barry Schwartz, or more importantly perhaps about the Shroud, or if you perhaps even want to find out how it might be possible to get him to speak, I would refer you to his website, shroud.com. So, are you there, Barry?
I'm here. Good to be with you, Roy.
Thanks. It's always nice to talk to you. And so I guess the first question is, I mean, it's kind of jumping in the middle, but, you know, are you a believer in the authenticity of the Shroud, and what made you one?
Well, yes. Let me state without any hesitation that I have come to accept that the Shroud of Turin is the authentic burial shroud of the historic Jesus. It was a long journey to get there because when I was first asked to participate in the scientific examination of the Shroud of Turin, I said basically no, because I felt that this wasn't something that I wanted to get involved with. I felt this was more of a religious object. I was raised in an Orthodox tradition. I didn't really know much about Christianity at the time. But I felt very uncomfortable perhaps getting involved with something that was such a iconic kind of symbol of Christianity in many respects. So I basically said no, and it was but there are certain properties of the image on the shroud that are truly unique to that piece of cloth and to that image. And so my curiosity as a professional technical photographer certainly was there. And so I was very interested in the shroud from an imaging point of view. But I was very apprehensive about getting involved with as something I saw as a kind of a religious symbol. The only saving grace was that the majority of the team members that were on the Shroud of Turin research project were not necessarily deeply.
Well, I'm sorry about that. We seem to have lost Barry for a few moments, but we have him back. Barry, we lost you just when you were talking about your initial reluctance to join the team, but then it turned out that a number of the other scientists were not a religious Christian or Catholics.
Correct. And I think one of the things that ultimately kept me on the team, aside from my strong interest in the unique properties of the image itself, which had sort of already been recently discovered by a number of these gentlemen on our team, who ultimately came up with the idea of putting a team together based on revealing those properties. So ultimately, I was rather uncomfortable with the whole thing, and I had felt, do I really want to get involved with this? But the primary purpose of the team was simply to determine how the image was formed. It wasn't to try and prove this was Jesus. It wasn't trying to prove the resurrection or something of that nature. And there was very little talk about religion, although there were several priests who were involved with our team from the Holy Shroud Guild who acted as liaison for our team with the Turin authorities and with King Umberto, who was the owner of the Shroud at the time. So a few months into the project, I was still feeling a little uncomfortable, and a couple of new members had been added to our team from the Jet Propulsion Laboratories in Pasadena. One of those gentlemen, a good Catholic man, Don Lynn, he and I were very close friends from the very beginning. He was sort of my hero on the team. And I remember saying to Don one day, again, when I was feeling a little uneasy about my participation, I said, gee, Don, what's a nice Jewish boy like me doing on this team? And Don turned to me and he looked and he said, well, apparently you've forgotten that the man in question is a Jew. And I said, no, that's probably the only thing I knew about Jesus at the time, that he was Jewish. And so I said, no, that wasn't it. And he said, so you don't think God would want one of his chosen people on our team? And then I laughed and I said, no, I never thought that. And he gave me some great advice at that moment. He said, listen, Barry, go to Turin, do the very best job you can do. God doesn't tell us in advance what the plan is, but one day you'll know. And on those words, I stayed on the team. And I'm very grateful that before Don passed away, I was able to thank him for saying those words to me and keeping me on the team, because ultimately that altered the course of my life. So at that point in time, I stopped worrying about it and started focusing in on the real task, which was trying to determine how the image on that piece of cloth was formed.
And your background, of course, had been as a, I don't know what how to describe it, but as a very technically sophisticated photographer.
Yeah, I was a graduate of Brooks Institute of Photography, which was a very highly regarded school in its day. We studied the underlying technology of photography, the chemistry, the physics. So I had a very good handle on the technology itself, albeit analog in those days. And so I was very comfortable working in an environment with researchers and scientists and doctors and people of that nature, a lot of engineers and physicists through my career. So being involved on a team of this nature was great, but I'd never been on a really purely scientific team like the Shroud of Turin Research Project. It was truly unique because it had experts from Los Alamos National Laboratories and the Air Force Weapons Lab and Sandia Laboratories and the Jet Propulsion Lab and a number of other very high-tech scientific organizations. So it was great honored actually to be in and amongst that group of people. And of course, Roy, you and I've had now some time to sit and talk to each other, and you know that for me to talk is not that difficult. I do a lot of it. But in those days, I was a very quiet guy. I was the fly on the wall. I was so in awe of being in a room with scientists of this caliber that I kept my mouth shut, and perhaps that's how I learned some things in my involvement with these guys.
They were really world-class scientists in their fields.
They were. They were truly world-class. Look, Los Alamos is a very special laboratory. Obviously, it's a weapons laboratory. The United States government doesn't put a bunch of wackos there. Those guys are all first-class scientists of the highest caliber, the best training. And so it was a great honor and a privilege for me to actually be a member of that team once I overcame that initial kind of fear that I had about getting involved with this religious object.
So what are some of the unique image characteristics of the image on the shroud?
Well, I'll go right to the one that hooked me immediately. And it's a little difficult, you know, photography is worth, you know, photographs worth 1,000 words. I'll see if I can do it in less than 1,000 words here. One of the most unique properties of the image is that the lights and darks of the image itself, or the image density as we call it, is directly proportionate to the distance between the cloth and the body at the moment the image formed. That means that depth, or spatial information was encoded into the shroud's image. ultimately, that can be extracted and one can form a natural relief of the human form that cloth covered, and normal photography and normal artworks do not incorporate that kind of depth or spatial information, much like a topographical map. Now, that was something that was discovered early on by a few members of our team, and they used an old analog device called a VP8 image analyzer. But that device extracted and yielded the natural relief of the form of the man that was covered by the cloth, and a normal photograph or a normal artwork does not incorporate that kind of data. So that was the catalyst that formed, that caused these guys to want to form a team and go to Turin and try and figure out how an image like that could form on a sheet of linen. And that property was the one that hooked me right from the beginning.
So basically, there is a way to take the image on the Shroud of Turin and create essentially a three-dimensional image from information that is sort of hidden in the two-dimensional image on the Shroud.
Exactly. It's like I say, it's always a rather complex thing to describe. And of course, you saw my presentation where I actually can show some slides from the VP8 and some video footage from the VP8 screen. So you can actually see that that information is there. And of course, that information can be extracted now using a number of other techniques, including digital software will reveal that that information is truly embedded in the Shroud's image.
And that technology was developed for the space program or something originally?
Well, you know, they keep saying that. The VP8 image analyzer was over at Sandia Laboratories, and they were using it basically to see if they could extract more information from X-rays they were using. So they were using, they were taking X-rays of whatever it is they were taking X-rays of, and to get more information out of the X-rays, which were very subtle in tone, they got this device that could take the grayscale of the X-ray and break it into 8 bits, 8 levels of gray, thus somewhat enhancing what might be there and revealing what might be in the X-ray that is not so visible to the eye, unaided eye.
Okay.
So they had it there for that purpose. It really had nothing to do with space. The VP8 was not used by NASA to map the moon or Mars, as some people have said.
Well, I've heard a lot of myths, I guess, in
a lot of mythology.
So you, I remember that you mentioned another thing that really pushed you over the edge having to do with the bloodstains on the Shroud.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the things that pushed me back over the other edge, basically, because when I obviously one of the primary theories was the Shroud was some form of painting or artwork. So that was one of the things that we went there to determine. And it, I would say it took maybe 15 minutes with the Shroud in front of me and with my high-powered magnifier in hand to realize is that if this was a painting of some sort, it was a painting without paint, because you can look at it with a magnifying glass or better yet, of course, with a microscope, which we ultimately did, and you can see that there's no paint or pigment on the cloth. It's simply the discoloration of certain surface fibers that are responsible for that yellowish-colored image. But there's no paint or pigment added to create that color. And it took maybe 15 minutes for us to see that. But there was a problem, and that was that as we stood there and looked at this cloth, we noted that the blood stains on the cloth were still red. And old blood is supposed to turn black or brown often within an hour or even less. And here's blood that ostensibly might be 2,000 years old, at least 700 years old, based on, you know, just looking at its recorded, documented, unbroken chain of history. And yet we have this blood still reddish and crimson in color. And that was a deal breaker for me. Vernon Miller, who was the chief scientific photographer, dear friend of mine, also now passed away. Vernon and I looked at that. He had a lot more experience in forensics than I did. And he said, that's not right. The old blood's not supposed to be looked that way. And that was a real question mark that ultimately took another 17 years or so before was properly answered, at least in my mind, for me to get over that and sort of push that aside and look at the other facts of the Shroud as supporting its authenticity. But that was a deal breaker for me at the time. And it wasn't until, 1995, I was on the phone with Dr. Alan Adler, another Jewish member of our team and a world-renowned blood chemist, and I happened to bring up the fact that nobody had explained the red blood. And Al said, "Didn't you read my paper?" And I said, "I did, but I'm not a blood chemist, so it's a little over my head." He said, "Well, I found a very high content of bilirubin in the blood that was on the Shroud. Bilirubin is generated by the liver. Typically, when somebody's beaten severely, tortured, not given any water, the body goes into shock. The liver starts pumping bilirubin into the bloodstream. Bilirubin is a hemolytic agent, breaks down the blood, the red blood cell walls, and the blood remains red forever." And, of course, that was sort of a aha moment for me, because that was the last piece of the puzzle all those years later, back in 1995. That ultimately pushed me over the threshold of accepting the Shroud as authentic. But I didn't rush into it, and I needed a proper answer. And, of course, I had to believe Al. He was Jewish. But he was also a world-renowned expert, and he was very clear on that. Now, it turns out there's probably another reason why the blood is red in addition to that. And since we're talking about it, I might as well just finish the story. When they manufactured linen in the ancient methods, linen is rather stiff when it's woven together, unlike cotton, which is quite soft and pliable. And they would rinse the cloth, the woven cloth, in a naturally occurring detergent called soapwort from a plant, soapwort, Saponaria officinalis. And they would wash it in that and rinse it and dry it in the air by evaporation. And it left a little surface layer of that on the top of the fibers as anything that dries by evaporation does. Saponaria officinalis is also a hemolytic agent. So it's a combination of the bilirubin in the blood and the treatment of the clot itself that caused the blood to remain red. So you can see that since 1995, we got the more information about it. We now know that it's most likely a combination of those two effects that caused the blood on the shroud to remain red.
And as long as you just mentioned it, I assume that the cloth itself of the shroud is very consistent with its authenticity.
It is. It would have been quite an expensive cloth in the first century. Excuse me. It's a herringbone woven cloth, which is sort of a 3/2 twill weave. And it was not a common cloth, would have been an expensive cloth in the first century. And, of course, skeptics like to say that, well, they didn't have that kind of cloth in the first century. And I guess technically skeptics could be right, because the first known example of herringbone weave was 500 BC. So obviously it's been around for a long time, well before the Shroud of Turin. My feeling is this. It tells us in the Gospels that the cloth was provided by Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy man. Doesn't tell us much else about him, but just the fact that he was a wealthy man would indicate that he could afford a high-quality cloth like this. We don't know if he already owned it, perhaps for his own death, or perhaps he went out and bought it. It doesn't tell us that in the gospel, so we can only hypothesize on that. But it would have probably come from Syria, would have been probably the nearest place where that kind of cloth was manufactured, which means it would have come in on the back of a camel. And so it would have been an imported piece of cloth and would have been more expensive than something created and woven locally. So, but it's very consistent with that kind of burial cloth. And it's also, as it states in the Torah, of clean linen raiment. It's pure linen with no cotton or wool interwoven with it, no mixing of the kinds. And that is right from the Torah, that clean linen raiments would be used, particularly if somebody of high stature, someone that certainly the disciples of Jesus believed, they believed he was the Messiah, they wouldn't have wrapped him in a cheap piece of cloth. They would have gotten the best they could get in their hands at that moment in their time.
In fact, it wouldn't be kosher if it was cotton and linen, right?
That's correct.
And they're not going to bury the Messiah in a treif cloth.
Well, and that's the other thing that some people, modern researchers, say, well, the shroud was the tablecloth of the Last Supper. Well, it's pretty hard for me to fathom that the disciples who believed this was the Messiah, or at least most of them did, would wrap him in a dirty linen tablecloth. I mean, that's just ludicrous, and I always jokingly say, well, if you think that's the case, you don't know very many Jewish people, because
well,
you wouldn't have done that.
I have a vague memory. It is a little dangerous, you know, flying by the seat of my pants, but I have a vague memory that my grandfather lived with his burial cloth to be, that it was a tradition to have it in advance to remind yourself of your mortality. Does that ring a bell?
Well, you know, it's funny. My father was buried in a white shroud, similar to the Shroud of Turin, in a plain wooden box, taking of any of the fluids out of the body. He was not, my brain is locking on.
Embalmed or anything.
Embalmed, thank
yeah.
you. He was not embalmed. He was wrapped in a plain linen sheet, pure linen. White linen, very much like the shroud, and that was in 2003. So I think that the tradition of that, and my father had all the arrangements made well in advance. So he owned the cloth, he had paid for everything, the pine box, the burial. So I think that it may well be part of Jewish tradition. I'm certainly not an authority on that subject, but I think it may well be a tradition that many people would prepare themselves for burial by having these materials already in place.
In which case, Joseph of Arimathea could have simply donated his burial cloth to be
exactly
he donated the grave according to the scripture
as well. So if he had a grave, it's most likely he would have also had the burial shroud, and so he gave that up and gave it over so that they could use it for Jesus. So the way I see it, that's very consistent with what Jewish customs and culture would do. People often forget the context of the times. You know, we try and apply our 21st century mentality to something 2,000 years ago, and the culture has changed. One has to look at the cultural context, which I think some people forget to do.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons I have this show is to remind people of the Jewishness of Jesus.
Yeah, and in this case, I think that it's about as authentic as you can get, really.
I'm going to interrupt our conversation with Barry Schwartz at the moment in order to make a short break in the program and let our listeners know, especially if they've tuned in after the beginning of the program, that we are talking with Barry Schwartz, who was the official photographer on the first scientific investigation of the Shroud of Turin in 1978, and intimately involved in the scientific examination of the Shroud since then, and has become quite an authority on all of the evidence for the authenticity of the Shroud, and he is Jewish. He is a was a Jewish professional photographer who got involved with the Shroud. He's still Jewish, although he thoroughly supports the authenticity of the Shroud and defends it and has certainly the scientific knowledge and background and intimate experience with the Shroud itself to be a very authoritative voice attesting to its authenticity. So we've been speaking with my Jewish friend Barry Schwartz about the Shroud of Turin, and we will continue doing so after the break. You're listening to Roy Shoman on Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. Welcome back. This is Roy Shoman. You're listening to Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria. And we are speaking today with Barry Schwartz, a Jewish man who was the official photographer on the original Shroud of Turin scientific investigation in 1978. And since then, and of course that's about 35 years ago, has become one of the foremost world experts and authorities on all of the scientific details about the Shroud of Turin, almost all of which attest to its authenticity as what it purports to be and as dating from 2,000 years ago and so forth. So we will now resume our conversation with Barry Schwartz about the Shroud of Turin. So are there any other aspects of the Shroud which reveal Jewish burial customs or the Jewishness of the setting?
Well, I think that, there's a lot of gospel, in the gospel accounts of what was done to Jesus. The language is a little confusing, and I think there is a confusion that people have because it mentions in the New Testament in the tomb was the burial shroud and a separate cloth folded separate from the rest. And it also mentions linen strips. This has given many Christians the idea that Jesus was buried by wrapping the body the way the Egyptians did, as a mummy, with strips of linen. Well, by the first century, even the Egyptians had stopped wrapping mummies that way. And however, if you have a long burial shroud, put the feet at one end, the head in the middle, and then bring the cloth back up over the head and back to the feet, if you move the body, the cloth's just going to fall off. So they would use linen strips to bind the body into the cloth at that point in time, and I think that's what it talks about in the Gospels when they say that there were linen strips. And the second cloth, separate but folded and separate from the other, was the face cloth that would have been placed over his head when he was brought down off the cross. We still cover the faces of the dead today at accident scenes or wherever else, or even in the hospitals. They would have covered his face, taken him to the tomb. They would have removed that cloth and placed it in the tomb because it had blood and fluid on it, so it's required by Jewish law to be buried with the body. But they would have kept it there in the tomb, and that's mentioned in the gospel. So to me, that's very consistent with a first century Jewish burial. As far as I'm concerned, there's nothing about what is described in the gospels that goes against our knowledge of the shroud. And that second cloth that I mentioned, the face cloth, is known as the sudarium, and it's in Spain. It's been there since about the 5th century. Documented without a broken chain of custody. And because some people say if it says there were two clauses in the gospel, the shroud is a single clause, so it can't be authentic, which to me is sort of laughable considering that after 2,000 years, it's quite logical that the two clauses might have gotten separated. Yeah. But everything about the description of what was in that tomb is very consistent with the first century Jewish burial.
When you mentioned the blood remaining red, I forgot the name of the blood component, but you said that it happens when the victim dies in a great deal of pain or agony. Is there anything else about the shroud that reflects the suffering that Jesus went through during the Passion?
Sure. I mean, if we look at the gospel account of what was done to Jesus, we can start at the top of the head. He was crowned or capped with probably a cap of thorns. They didn't weave a pretty little crown to put around his head, and imagine telling a Roman soldier that this criminal you're about to kill, before you do that, let's make him look nice. That's silly. They took a nasty thorn bush and they smashed it down on his head, and the head of the man of the shroud is covered with wounds and blood stains as if from a cap or crown of thorns. If you go down and look at his face is severely beaten, both cheekbones swollen, one more so than the other. There's blood on his face and on his beard. If you go down a little further, from the neck to the ankles on the back as well as the front of the body, are well over 120 scourge marks from a Roman flagrum. It's a documented torture device the Romans used. It had dumbbell-shaped lead weights on the end. A hat tip to Mel Gibson for making it far more dramatic in his film by using hooks or scorpioni, which the Romans did use when they were, that was a tool for capital punishment. They would kill you with that. They didn't use that on Jesus. They wanted him to die up on the cross where everybody could see it, not on the ground. But in making the film, Mel Gibson used artistic license to make it more graphic and make you feel the horror of it even that much more by extreme close-ups. So there's the rending of the flesh there, but we have scourge marks literally from his neck down to his ankles, and not just on the back of the body, but also on the front. We go down a little bit further, and there's a large oval spear wound in the side with a blood flow emanating from it. And interestingly, when we look at that blood flow with ultraviolet fluorescence photography, we can see a serum halo surrounding that blood stain. And when we examine other blood stains on the shroud, we find that serum halo around many of the blood stains on the cloth. And for somebody to tell me that an artist put that there in hopes that someday they would invent a technology that would allow us to see these serum stains is sort of ludicrous.
What's a serum halo?
The serum is the liquid portion of your blood. You know, our blood is comprised of a liquid portion, which is called serum, and then it has red blood cells and white blood cells that give it its color and also protect us from, you know, viruses and things. That's what the white blood cells are there for, to fight off disease and viruses and bacteria. And so the liquid portion of the blood is only, that serum stain is only visible with UV fluorescence. It's not visible to the naked eye. So to get me to believe that some medieval guy, some forger, put that there in hopes that someday we would find it is sort of ludicrous. So we have that, and we continue down on looking at the man's body, and we can only see the back of his hands. We cannot, his arms are crossed over his torso. So we can only see one exit wound in, at the back of one hand or wrist where one of the crucifixion nails would have come out. If we go further down, we can then see the blood stains at the feet and ankles from the crucifixion nails that were used to hold his feet in place on the cross. So everything that is described in the Gospels is documented with absolute 100% forensic accuracy on the Shroud of Turin. So it's a very strong argument in favor of this is not an artwork. The only way this could have really occurred, in my opinion, is by some interaction between a cloth and the body that it covered. And to me, that's really the only way this could have happened. It's certainly not an artwork or a photograph or a scorch, as some skeptics would have us believe.
I had the pleasure and privilege to see the Shroud when it was on exhibit. I think it was in 2000 and again maybe in 2002. I don't remember exactly which years it was.
98 and 2000.
98 and 2000. And I remember being struck by a couple of things. One was you could actually see two crisscrossed kind of lines of direction of the scourge marks, like that there was a person
right.
whipping him from either side.
It's true. Now, the guys who are far better at this than I am, the real forensic guys, have studied the scourge marks on the body and were able to determine that there were two men applying the scourges or the flagrum to the body, and they could even determine which one was right-handed and which one was left-handed, if I remember correctly. So the forensic evidence, you know, we've come full circle now to where forensics is a well-known science thanks to all the popularity of all these TV shows that immediately solve the crime within an hour. In the real world, of course, that's not the way it works, but we've all become very familiar with the terminology of forensics. And when you look at the Shroud now and you study the forensic aspects of it, and no less than three real experts have done so over the last 30 years, you have to realize that this is a cloth that wrapped a real body, that the knowledge that we have today, the forensic knowledge today, still makes it almost impossible for us to duplicate it. Certainly some medieval person trying to create an image like this would not have had a clue how to do it and would not have been able to incorporate the forensic accuracy that we see there.
That begs the question. If you assembled your team of Shroud scientists with the project of counterfeiting the Shroud, could they even do it today?
You know, that's a great question, Roy. No. Ironically, we live in the most image-oriented era of human history. Everybody's got a camera and a computer in their hand nowadays. So imaging is something we all do. And yet, with all the technology that's available to us now, no one has been able to duplicate the chemistry and physics and create an image with those same properties. You can make something that looks like the shroud. I mean, after all, my photographs have been on the internet for almost 20 years. And so you can use that as a reference. And the skeptics who use my photographs as a reference, even they have trouble getting it to look like the man of the shroud. It's more cartoon-like in most cases. And when we then apply some of the same tests that we applied to the Shroud of Turin, the chemistry, the physics are all completely off and don't match at all what's on that cloth. And that's, to me, you know, one of the great kind of questions that we answered was, could this be manufactured? And I don't believe there's anyone who could come even into the ballpark of making an image with these same properties. No one ever has.
With all of our 21st century technology, much less
with all of our 21st
13th century.
Exactly. And with all the attempts by skeptics to duplicate the image, you know, you can make something that sort of looks like the shroud, but if it doesn't have the same chemistry and physics, if it doesn't have the same physical properties as the image on the shroud, then you're wrong, and it's not correct.
You mentioned the attempts by skeptics to show how the shroud was made looking cartoonish, and my guess is what you're referring to is the theory that the shroud is somehow produced by a contact effect, which would then distort the image because as the cloth is draped over the body or the bas-relief or the statue or whatever, it ends up being horizontally stretched, so to speak.
Yeah, you would get cloth drape distortion. And that's assuming that the body image was formed by direct contact with the cloth. And the people who make those claims are correct. If the shroud image were solely formed by direct contact, then we would expect to find that kind of distortion in the image, and we don't. But we also know that the shroud image is not the product of direct contact because there are many places where the cloth is separated from the body, for example, with the hands across the torso. And where the hands are, they have lifted the cloth away from the torso. And if you look at a photographic image of the shroud, you'll see there's sort of a halo, a lighter image around the hands where the distance between the cloth and the torso itself was increased because the hands were there. And we found that, and they've been able to compute this very accurately scientifically, the image formation mechanism, whatever it was, worked at a distance of up to 4 centimeters away from the body, after which there was no more imaging. That's how that spatial data we talked about earlier got encoded. There's a correlation between image density and cloth body distance that encodes that distance information, but it also proves that the image on the cloth was not made by direct contact because we know there's imaging going on up to about 4 centimeters between the cloth and the body.
I'll say something that's, of course, painfully obvious, but pseudo-debunking that says that it was somehow faked would be predicated on the idea that 500 years before the invention of photography, they decided to fake a negative concept.
That's correct. We know that the first negative was created by Nietzsche Nietzsche in, I believe it was 1826. And that negative, that glass plate that he created, is still on display in a museum in Texas somewhere. So there, I don't know how it got to Texas, but that's where it is. So we know that photography is an invention at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution and not a medieval invention. Some people believe that Leonardo da Vinci did it with a camera obscura and a light-sensitive photographic emulsion. Well, that's interesting because one of the concerns that we were there to examine, you know, there are many burn holes in the shroud that came from a fire in 1532. And one theory was that the reliquary, which was lined with wood but had silver on the outside, that some of that silver melted and dripped through and burned holes into the shroud. So we went there looking for silver in the peripheral of those burn holes, but also anywhere else on the cloth, and we found zero silver anywhere. And we used techniques like pyrolysis mass spectrometry, which can virtually detect one part per billion of any chemical element you're looking for. We found zero silver, and the people who are proponents of that theory say, well, the silver was washed away. Well, if you understand how photography works, where the image is, the silver remains, the unused silver is removed by the fixer, and you would still have silver where the image is. And we would have detected it. And remember, we're talking about a cloth, a woven cloth, which somebody would have had to coat with a silver light-sensitive emulsion, which would have embedded itself down into between the fibers, and we would have found tons of silver on the cloth had it been manufactured that way or had the image been made that way. We found zero silver. So there was no light-sensitive emotion ever on the Shroud of Turin, and the negative properties of the image were not a product of a photographic process, but have the same properties as a photographic negative. Very interesting.
Now, you, if it's not a photographic process, what's the disproof of the claim that it could be a painted image?
Well, you can't have a painting if there's no paint. It's as simple as that. And although a few particulates have been found on the shroud that are paint, they are few and far between. They do not comprise the image. They're sort of scattered randomly across the cloth. And you have to understand there are 52 documented occasions where artists were permitted to paint a replica of the shroud and then lay the shroud, lay their replica onto the shroud to sanctify it, create a relic, if you will. And at that point in time, transference of a few particles of paint is not only expected, but if it weren't there, I would be questioning. So there are a few particles of paint that have been found on the shroud, but no more so in the image areas than in the non-image areas, sort of scattered randomly across. Now, one of the pigments that were historically used in medieval times is something called vermilion, which is really red iron oxide, rust if you want to get technical, Fe2O3, red iron oxide, but always mixed with cobalt and manganese. We found some particulates of red iron oxide, again, evenly distributed across the entire cloth, and it was pure red iron oxide, not mixed with cobalt and manganese, so it's not a pigment. It's a byproduct of the retting process. When you make linen, you start with the flax plant. The first thing you do is you soak it in water. It's called retting. And any iron in the water is going to embed itself into that flax material and ultimately show up as microscopic, and I mean microscopic particles on the shroud. And it's pure red iron oxide, and it's found across the entire shroud. But if you scraped it all into a pile, you'd still need a microscope to see it. It's that minute of an amount. It is not responsible for the image. But it's something skeptics have used. Oh, there's red iron oxide, so it must be a painting. Well, it's pure red iron oxide, the byproduct of the linen retting process, definitely not from paint or pigment.
Okay.
Our team had, just one final thought on this. Our team was so well prepared that we had the spectral characteristics with us of every paint and pigment known to man from medieval to modern times. We had a database with us, not in a computer, but an actual printed out plot of every chemical element. And, you know, we went there looking for paint, obviously, as one of the things that part of the mystery we were trying to solve was, is this a painted object or not? Now, I always ask people, if you look at the quality of the scientists that were on our team, guys from all these wonderful laboratories, how long do you think it would take for them to have found paint on the shroud if it were painted? 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours? It wouldn't have taken very long for us to find it covered with paint. And I stupidly, at the earliest stages, before we went to Turin, opened my mouth and said, oh, you know, give us 5 minutes, we'll find the paint and the brushstrokes, we'll come home. Well, it's 36 years later, and there's no paint or brushstrokes, and I'm still doing this because just all the things that I sort of thought that would easily dismiss this were ultimately dismissed themselves.
You mentioned in passing the hands, you know, the hands folded over the middle of the image and a single nail, presumably exit wound in one wrist. So that means the nails went through the wrists?
Well, you know, the Greek word for hand doesn't distinguish between the dead center of the palm and 1 inch closer to the wrist, which I always do this demonstration in my lectures. If you take your thumb and your little finger and you put them together, you look at the two fleshy parts of the palm, and there's like a groove that runs down between those two fleshy parts called the thenar furrow. And if you have to nail 100 people to a cross today, you're going to find the quickest, simplest way of getting a good purchase on where you're going to drive that nail by putting the little finger and thumb together, creating that thenar furrow, putting the nail there, and hammering it through. It's much more difficult for somebody to rip their hand loose than if it's an inch toward the center of the palm where the phalanges are, where it might be easy for a strong man to rip himself loose while he's being tortured. So the Romans knew how to do this, and although we can only see the exit wound at the back of the hand, the exit wound is consistent with the nail going through that fleshy part of the palm, but it's still the palm. So when people want to split hairs sometimes and say, well, you know, the palm is in the middle of the hand. Well, technically, the palm is the whole inside of the hand except for the fingers. So anywhere in there would be acceptable, And as I said, the Greek word doesn't distinguish between the center of the palm and an inch closer to the wrist.
So if I understand correctly, what you're saying in part is it would only be rational for the exit wound to be through the wrist because it makes a more secure purchase. It basically
Absolutely.
Nails the victim much more securely.
Absolutely. And when I say at the back of the wrist, it's not right all the way down at the wrist bones, but above that still. Like I said, if you consider where that inner furrow is, drive a nail through there at a slight angle, you'll see that it comes out sort of at the base of the back of the palm, but not all the way into the wrist bones. Wherever this nail was driven through, it would not have broken any of the bones of the hand. It would have gone through without doing so. But those bones would have served to fasten that hand very tightly to the cross so that the man couldn't tear his hand loose.
Well, let me ask you about some other claims made about the shroud, and I'm
sure.
I mean, obviously, I want you to be honest, and there is always a danger in these things for people to get a little over-enthusiastic and perhaps go a little further than the scientific evidence supports. So I'm not presuming
sure.
which category these are in, okay?
Sure.
But a couple of these things are, let's see, the pollen in the cloth, coins on the eyes, mm-hmm. Flower images on the cloth, I guess are three
okay.
things that come to mind.
Okay, let's talk about, let's just call them, generally, let's call them secondary images. Okay, first of all, there's no scientific evidence to support any of those claims.
Even the pollen,
Well, let's talk about the pollen first. The man who lifted the pollen on tape samples from the shroud just prior to starting our examination in 78 was a man named Max Fry. I documented everything he did very carefully photographically, and you'll find those images in our collections. Max Fry used dime store sticky tape, used his thumb to apply it, and peeled up, pulling up on the shroud, putting a lot of strain on the shroud. And from that, he claimed to be able to identify certain pollens as being specifically from, from the Jerusalem area. Now, of course, for years, we thought that was wonderful information. He released a photomicrograph, actually a scanning electron microscope photograph of a pollen, and he said this is what he found, and we all saw that as reasonably credible at the time. It wasn't until the death of Max Fry that it was determined that the sample slide he'd given us all that we were all using in our presentation was an actual reference slide of an actual pollen, not one from the shroud, but a reference sample. It turns out that ancient pollens, by the way, pollens aren't hollow. They have an interior that's called mintine that's more like a pulp, like the inside of a tree. And that, over time, will dry out. And the more ancient the pollen, of course, the more dried out it gets. And when it dries out, the external pressure increases to a point where it crushes the pollen, making it virtually impossible to identify ancient pollens just by visual inspection. When everybody went back and re-examined the work done by Fry, it turns out that many of the pollens that he was claiming to be able to identify by genus and species, it's just impossible to do so according to the palynographers, who are real pollen experts, and they say that's just not possible to do visual identification. They can now do DNA analysis of pollens to determine what genus and species they might be, but visual inspection is not a credible way of doing so. So the claims made by Fry have sort of been discounted now and sort of cast aside. So there is no hard scientific evidence to support the claim that those pollens that he identified were accurately identified at all.
Are those pollens, can people get a hold of those pollens and do the DNA testing today?
The entire Fry collection is in the hands of one researcher here in the United States. He has not made them available.
Okay.
So unfortunately, there's that. So let's talk about flowers.
Okay.
Because the flower theory is has been proposed by a man named Avinoam Danin, an Israeli botanist, dear friend, just saw him last year in Jerusalem. He has now claimed to find over 5,000 flower images or plant images on the shroud. And this comes up frequently in my lectures, and people always say, what about the flower images? And I say, well, how many do you see? And there's usually a little bit of a silence there, and then they say, well, we really don't see any. And I say, well, I rest my case that, without getting into a long dissertation on human visual perception, our brains have a tendency to fill in the blanks when we look in a random pattern and fill in the blanks to make something identifiable out of the noise that we're looking at. And our brains do this without any input from us, without any conscious effort on our parts. It's just part of our visual perception system. remember that the eye inputs the information. It goes right out the back of the eye through the optic nerve straight to the brain, and the brain manipulates the data before we perceive it, and it all happens virtually at the speed of light. And so ideally, if these images were there, we should be able to measure them in some way, perhaps with spectral analysis, other kinds of imaging. But the perception of these flowers, is it unusual for a man who's a botanist and is familiar with all these plant images that are out there and all these plants, that when he looks into a random shapes that he finds in the patterns on the shroud, that his perception is, that looks like a such and such a plant? Well, there's a term for that. It's called pareidolia. And pareidolia, the best example of pareidolia is the man in the moon. Is there a face of a man in the moon? Some people see one. And does that make it credible scientifically? No. And so, unfortunately, we have a lot of people making claims of secondary images, not just of flower images, but of implements of the passion, a whip, a spear, sandals. People have found all this on the shroud. Other people have found written inscriptions, including supposedly a death certificate, which, of course, they didn't do in the first century, so sorry about that. Historically, inaccurate, but an interesting theory. And so I always tell people that, look, do you see the image of the man? And, of course, even the boldest skeptics will say, yeah, well, we see the image of the man, of course. Well, isn't that what this is about? It's not about what might or might not be secondary images. The problem is our brains are designed to make sense of what we look at, and they do it without a lot of help. So, that's why some people can look at the shape of a mountain and see a face or see a body or whatever it happens to be. Does that mean that's what's there? Not really, but that's their perception of it. And so we suffer from that, especially now that everybody can manipulate images in their computer. You should see the images people send me, including I got one yesterday from a lady who took a picture of a mountain, and when she turned it sideways, it sort of had the shape of a body under a cloth, and that's what she saw. Does that mean that's what's really there? Not really.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to break this conversation at this point. We're out of time for today. We've been speaking with the Jewish photographer, Barry Schwartz, who was the official photographer on the original scientific investigation into the Shroud of Turin. And he has been speaking out of his immense expertise and experience with the Shroud on many aspects of the Shroud's authenticity, of which he has become thoroughly convinced and quite a great apologist at conferences and talks around the world. His website is shroud.com, which is the foremost website in the world for details on the Shroud of Turin. I strongly encourage you to visit it. And we will have to continue our conversation next week with Barry Schwartz on the Shroud of Turin. This is Roy Shoman, your host. The show is Salvation is from the Jews. Thank you for listening, and I hope you listen again next week to the continuation of our very rich and interesting conversation with Barry Schwartz, the photographer of the Shroud of Turin. Bye for now.